Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
So we'll apologize in advance. We have our little furry co-hosts at our feet, again, chewing on bones. It's funny. You gave each of them a bone, and then each of them wanted the other dog's bone. So they end up switching, which they're like little kids. They always want what the other one has. So hopefully that's not too distracting, but there's really no other way for us to do this because they won't stay out of the room, and we have to take them everywhere. And we have to keep them occupied. So Bob is the original co-host, and now Vivi is the poodle that we have.
Our new poodle puppy.
Yeah, she's 8 months standard. She's 8 months old, and are she almost 9 months old now?
February.
But she's got to be close to 50 pounds. I mean, she's a big girl. For sure. It's amazing and how we picked her up on your birthday, April 15th. And now it's amazing and how quickly when we picked her up, she's like 9 pounds and now she's almost 50.
She still thinks she's 9 pounds.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a little crazy. So this one, this is a question from Samantha. She's asking about progesterone, but, her diagnosis I think is somewhat interesting because it brings up some things to talk about. So when we just kind of dive into it, go ahead and, read the question from Samantha and we'll discuss.
Okay, so this question is from Samantha. It's a little bit more about not just progesterone, but I think also just kind of hormones, and we kind of talked about it a little bit before this podcast. But okay, so this is from Samantha. Question. Hi, I was diagnosed with ovarian failure at the age of 36. It's been 4 years now. I've been to a few different clinics trying to figure out what's going to work best for myself. Right now, I am using estrogen patches, which seem to work well, and Prometrium, which Prometrium's like a big box formulation of progesterone. My main problem that I still face is lack of sleep. The estrogen patches help my mood and sleep somewhat, and I've tried a few different progesterones, creams, pills, and have not really found any improvement in sleep from it. I'm wondering what is the brand name or if there's a slow-release progesterone that you described. Thanks.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So like I said, she's bringing up a couple of different things. Now, the interesting thing is which you don't see very often, ovarian failure at the age of 36. So how would a gynecologist diagnose that? Would it just be on an FSH level?
No, usually they'll do like a progesterone challenge. So somebody that hasn't had a period for months, if not years, they might be having some symptoms of quote unquote menopause. A lot of times if they are pretty young, they'll, of course, do the ultrasound to rule out polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, and then they'll do a progesterone challenge where they give them progesterone for so many days and then they stop it. And if those ovaries are quote unquote working, then they'll have a period. It'll basically stimulate a period. There's some other tests too, like you said, an FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, a luteinizing hormone, your estrogen and progesterone. But like you said, it's not common to have ovarian failure, but it happens.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we've both seen it a few different times. I mean, we don't see it a lot, but we've seen it a few different times. So the first thing that, based on her age, 36, she says four years, so she's 40 now. So she's getting into that perimenopausal window, but that doesn't really apply too much because she's already basically in a kind of a pseudo menopause based on that ovarian failure.
So with her question, she's saying, she's taking the hormones. So basically you're in some ways replacing those hormones that she's not making, like you would be in somebody that were menopausal or perhaps in their early 50s. So we had kind of talked about a little bit with being that young and having ovarian failure or her ovaries aren't working is different than a woman that's typically 51 and a half, which is the average age of menopause. You know, that's a good, 15 years of her own ovaries not producing hormones. So in that respect, not only are we just looking at her mood and her sleep and finding a you know, a treatment plan of hormones that is safe and works for her, but also we're thinking about a lack of hormones for 15 years, as would be in nature, like her bone density, her skin integrity. You know, there's so many other aspects that hormones have. So whenever I've had a patient with early menopause or perhaps ovarian failure, I kind of think about what's going to be the future for her when she's 65, 75 in terms of having that lack of hormones, which would have been about 15 years.
Yeah, right. So, you know, she's doing a patch and some Prometrium now, which I think is fine. That works for lots of women. But when I first read this, especially with the ovarian failure diagnosis, I thought that she'd be a perfect candidate, at least in my opinion anyways, she'd be a perfect candidate for rhythmic dosing. Because of her younger age, like you said, 15 years plus with no hormones, rhythmic dosing, the point of that is to restore those hormones to, you know, that of a 30, 35 year old, right? To really boost up that estrogen level, and to try to, you know, in some ways recreate what her body's not doing currently.
Exactly. As opposed to a woman that comes in to see us for menopausal symptoms, she might be 51. Then we're thinking, okay, we're looking at, of course, longevity, bone density, you know, brain, heart health, all that jazz. But a lot of times with that age, we do a lot less hormones and kind of work our way to find the right dosage, where somebody that's in their mid-30s, you might want to consider going a little higher on the hormones just to have that, you know, the health benefits from it. You know, there's lots of different ways to do it, but just to have those health benefits. And maybe you can explain a little bit about what rhythmic dosing is.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And we've talked about it before. We haven't talked about it a lot, but it is in a situation like this, or let's say she was 36 or mid 40s or early 40s and she had a hysterectomy, right? So now she's in surgical menopause. It's kind of the same idea. We are
in a total hysterectomy with the ovaries out. Sometimes they don't always take the ovaries out.
But even with a partial hysterectomy, right? Even if they have the ovaries there, when they leave the ovaries, you know, there's this idea that the hormones are going to be maintained. For some women, they are. Some women, they're not. Some women have symptoms right away. Some women, the symptoms are delayed for a long time. But that's still another example where rhythmic dosing, even though it might not seem age appropriate because she's only, you know, at this point, she's 40, but she was diagnosed at 36. Physiologically, it makes a lot of sense, at least for the way that we view it. Maybe not from a gynecological perspective, you know, conventionally, but we're trying to get those hormone levels up high enough, and a lack of estrogen. She's asking about sleep. A lack of estrogen, which is common in menopausal women, is part of the reason why they don't sleep very well, right? And that's one of her complaints, at least at this point. Now, we're taking a lot of things at face value. There's a bunch of backstory that we don't know about necessarily, you know, lab work and some objective findings. But, you know, at the same time, at least from a philosophy perspective, the two distinctions, static dosing, same dose every day, which with the patch, she's sort of doing, that's sort of a version of that. Where rhythmic dosing, literally, it is a changing dose over the course of a 28-day cycle. Now, she, even with ovarian failure, I'm assuming she would still be able to have a period if those hormone levels were high enough, right? She hasn't had an ablation. She hasn't had a hysterectomy. So if we are able to raise her estradiol level to a certain point, she would then start menstruating again, which, you know, again, that's part of the benefit as to why it's a good idea, because we're really increasing that estradiol level as a way to kind of recreate the female hormone cycle, which, you know, you can find some pictures online, you can see what it looks like, and there's this peak of estrogen, a peak of testosterone, a peak of progesterone. We're trying to, at least with the estrogen progesterone with rhythmic dosing protocol, we are trying to, you know, basically emulate that as much as we can.
So with a female that has a uterus, and you're basically recreating nature's cycle of, you know, the estrogen comes up. So just to back up a little bit. So in a perfect 28-day cycle, day one to day five, you're basically, hormones are low. You're going to have your period, the endometrial lining from the uterus is sloughing off. And then from about day four up to day 10, the estrogen starting to rise. And then on day 12, you have this huge peak of estrogen, which with ovaries, that's kind of a signal to help that fertile egg be released in ovulation. And then after that egg is released, you have a corpus luteum on the ovary from that release of the egg from ovulation. And then you start to make the progesterone from day 14 to day 28 with the progesterone's peak at day 21. So basically with doing rhythmic dosing is you're recreating that cycle of using bioidentical hormones. typically you can do estradiol cream, progesterone cream, and then sometimes I've used progesterone capsules with rhythmic dosing too. So there's, I mean, cool thing with bioidentical hormone replacement is you have so many, you know, aspects at your fingertips, but that's basically rhythmic dosing, which would be not a bad idea in Samantha's case, because then you are recreating the natural surge and cycle of hormones that her ovaries aren't producing.
Yeah, right. And from a, you know, from a symptom standpoint, you know, hot flashes, sleep, night sweats, mood, all those things could potentially be, you know, now granted, we're making some assumptions here and we're saying speculatively she could be, you know, she could benefit from that just by, you know, by elevating those, you know, those mainly the estrogen level. That's really the key here. Now, the patch, I think the patch, like I said, you know, we've had plenty of women over the years that use it. Some don't tolerate it very well at all. We've done some podcasts about that. But just based on, you know, her diagnosis, I think she'd be a really good candidate. Now, she's asking about progesterone specifically. This is where we contradict ourselves a little bit. We usually talk about in the context, quote unquote, context of static dosing, we usually recommend a sustained release progesterone capsule. That's what we do most of the time. And we get a lot of questions that come in asking between cream versus capsule. We typically go the capsule direction for most women. Because and this is really the big distinction, in static dosing, we don't want there to be any bleeding, right? No spotting, no bleeding, no nothing. Where in the rhythmic dosing, we are trying to, if they still have their uterus, we are trying to recreate the female cycle, right? That's the big difference. So we want bleeding in rhythmic dosing. We don't want bleeding in static dosing. That's why we use capsules in static dosing most of the time. And we use cream in rhythmic dosing most of the time. Okay, but like you just alluded to, there are some women where we still use capsules on the rhythmic dosing. You know, maybe they've had a hysterectomy, maybe there's some other issues going on, maybe they're not sleeping, maybe there's some reason as to why we would choose that, but it's very much on an individualized basis.
Because we do find with doing oral progesterone is a capsule orally, is that it does seem to help with the sleep quite a bit more than using a cream. So, you know, and that's one thing for us females, pretty much regardless of age, is we have more of a tendency towards having sleep issues than men. Men can sleep pretty good, but women, a lot of times it's not a hard time falling asleep. It's like, oh, I fall asleep easy. It's the staying asleep. And so I imagine with Samantha, that's probably the case with her, because you see that 9 times out of 10 with this kind of symptom picture is no problem falling asleep, but either waking up multiple times before your alarm goes off, or waking up for big chunks of time. Like, oh, I wake up at 2:30 and I can't get back to sleep to about 3:30 or 4. And then of course, by the time you fall back asleep, it's time to wake up pretty soon. So that's probably the main case, which is why we do like on that aspect using a sustained release progesterone, because if you take it in the evening as sustained release, it's going to stay in your system longer, as opposed to an instant release, which would be the Prometrium that she's describing here of taking. Prometrium is an instant release form of progesterone, is that can go into the bloodstream pretty fast, but then drop very fast. So that's why they find themselves awake at 3:30 in the morning. So like Samantha had mentioned here, she must have listened to another podcast or read another blog post of ours about talking about that sustained release progesterone. And I would say in her case, if she's doing pretty good with those patches are, you know, that possibly trying that sustained release progesterone would be a good idea.
Yeah, that could be maybe like the first thing she tries, right? To see if that, and from a dosage perspective, I would say, you know, conservatively, you could go all the way down to 50. I even have some that even go lower than that, 25. But a standard starting point would be 100 milligrams. Maybe she goes up to 150, 200 if need be. You know, that might help on the sleep side. And then depending on, you know, I'm assuming she's probably, well, it'd be interesting to see what dosage of the patch she's using. If she's using the, you know, there's what, 3 different dosages?
0.025. Yes, there's a few different doses on there. It's estradiol, so it can be fairly strong, and you change it twice a week. I'm thinking, you know, with Samantha, even though she had that kind of premature ovarian failure, probably prior to the age of 36, because she was diagnosed at 36, is she still has her uterus. So she'd want to use some form of progesterone, just because doing when you're taking any kind of estradiol or estrogen, that does tend to thicken up the lining of the uterus. And like we had mentioned in static dosing, which I would consider Samantha's protocol here as a static hormone dose, is she'd want to use something to keep the lining of the uterus thin so she's not, you know, chronically bleeding or allowing that lining to get super thick, which you don't want a thick lining chronically.
Yeah, yeah. Now, again, back to the static versus rhythmic dosing. Static dosing by far is probably 98% of hormone replacement out there. Rhythmic dosing is a pretty uncommon thing, especially conventionally. I had a patient just the other day sent an email in, you know, her urologist or something that does hormones says that you, you know, and she's menopausal. I think she's in her early, I have to remember, I think she's like in her early 50s. And she, you know, her urologist who, you know, is, you know, a urologist as a specialist, but also does hormones on the side, told her that she shouldn't be having a period in menopause. And of course, my patient was, you know, somewhat concerned, right? Because, you know, her other doctor told her something completely different, which does happen when doctors are not familiar with rhythmic dosing. They don't really understand the concept or the philosophy behind it. So they automatically kind of, you know, try to dissuade or, you know, try to tell their patients not to do it. So it raises some concerns. But the fact that she is having a period, and this goes for, you know, all women. Now, granted, some women have hysterectomies. It kind of minimizes any problems. But the fact that she is having a period, it's building up, sloughing off, the endometrial lining is building up, sloughing off every single month. That's what makes it a safe protocol. Where in static dosing, as we just said, we're not trying to contradict ourselves, that you can't usually create predictable bleeding in static dosing, which is what makes it somewhat dangerous and not a good idea. When it's, you know, pretty much consistent every 28 days, like with the rhythmic dosing, that, you know, the fact that it is consistent and predictable is what makes it safe for the patient to do.
Yeah. So in static dosing, you just want to make sure that that lining in the uterus stays thin. And one way to ensure that is to keep an, you know, keep some form of progesterone. More usually capsules, oral seems to do the trick to keep that lining thin. That would be, so that would be the one thing I'm thinking with Samantha. So like you said about her sleep is, oh, she could start as low as 25 milligrams. I'd say that'd probably be too low to help protect that uterus.
In this case.
Absolutely. So probably the Prometrium she's taking, it usually comes in two doses, 100 milligrams and 200 milligrams. I'd say for her doing a sustained release progesterone, you'd want to start probably at 100, that's probably just fine. That usually is. Some people, just because some women are more sensitive to estrogen than others, that they might need to go up to 125, 150, maybe 200. I have very few women on 200 milligrams of sustained release progesterone, but I have a lot on many on 100, and then probably 125, 150.
Sure.
Is good too.
Yeah. 100 seems to be like a good starting point, but some, now, she also is talking about sleep. Now, there's a bunch of other things that we do outside of hormones that help with sleep. So again, we're kind of talking about a bunch of different things. But, you know, as we all know, sleep is really important. And women in these, you know, it seems like men deal with more with like snoring and sleep apnea issues. And women deal with more hormonally driven sleep problems. You know, most men you talk to, they sleep, maybe they don't sleep great, but they sleep okay. Then it comes down to how much they're snoring and, you know, whether they have sleep apnea or not, which seems like it's, you know, we've had some female patients certainly that do have sleep apnea, but it seems like it's a much more male dominant kind of an issue where the, you know, I mean, honestly, probably between a woman in her 40s to all the way up to her mid 60s, besides hot flashes, sleep trouble is probably the number one thing that we deal with, you know, and granted, you know, the way you look, the way you feel, everything in between is going to be affected by, you know, how well you're sleeping on a nightly basis. So it, you know, it tends to be a, I mean, of course we know sleep is really important, but it becomes a really big deal for women when they're not sleeping, you know, very frustrating when they can't get a good night's rest.
No, absolutely. Sleep is foundational. So I'd say if anybody's experiencing like, oh, you know, I think I have, you know, some hormonal issues that are causing me to not sleep well, hot flashes is pretty obvious. Hot flashes, night sweats, you're kind of near that menopausal age. It's probably having to do with low estrogen. If you're having night sweats, but you're menstruating, so you're a menstruating female, that could be a little bit with progesterone or even which... it all, you know, all the hormones work together. They're not compartmentalized. Is probably her cortisol might be coming up a little bit too early in the middle of the night, which then wakes you up. So there, we'd probably look into a little bit of ways to kind of reduce that cortisol in the evening.
Yeah, right. Which, you know, can be a little challenging, but you know, in this case, right, so if she's a true ovarian failure, that means that her estrogen progesterone production is pretty much non-existent. So that lack of hormone creates this kind of unabated cortisol or stress hormone. And that, like you just said, kind of, you know, perpetually creates this sleepless situation, whether it's falling asleep or staying asleep, or, you know, for some women, they have both of those issues, you know, kind of simultaneously. Let's just run through a couple of quick ingredients, nutrients, herbs, things that we use for sleep that could be kind of used simultaneously with something like this.
I'd say first off, which is the simplest, easiest thing, is actually just maybe having a little bedtime snack. Because sometimes when you're sleeping, let's say you ate at 6 o'clock, and then by, you know, 2 in the morning, that's a good 8 hours. Sometimes some people, especially women, were more prone to it. Our blood sugar can drop a little. Our liver does, you know, a little gluconeogenesis. Our body creates a little cortisol to help that. Because actually, you know, cortisol can be life-saving. If I don't eat for a few days, my cortisol levels can help boost up my blood sugar along with that gluconeogenesis from the liver. So sometimes just having a little protein snack before bed can help balance that blood sugar. I'd say that'd probably be the first easiest thing.
Yeah, that's very simple. You know, maybe a protein and or fat snack of some sort. Nothing that's too glycemically heavy, you know.
Like ice cream? No.
Yeah, right, yeah.
More like a little nut butter, maybe a little, you know, a hard-boiled egg.
Yeah. No, hard-boiled egg before bed doesn't sound very exciting.
No, not like ice cream, right?
Sounds like a little boring, but hey,
if it helps you sleep.
Yeah, right. If it, does the trick of, you know, like you say, balancing blood sugar / cortisol, you know, keep everyone sleeping soundly. When we're talking about nutrients, what nutrients are your kind of go-tos?
A lot of times with bringing down that cortisol is doing, like lately we've been doing with patients, that magnesium threonate.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that one's got some good, there's some good research to back it up, but not to mention specifically for sleep, you know, kind of help calming that brain down. There's a bunch of different forms of magnesium. We use magnesium for a variety, you know, for everything from constipation to sleeping to anxiety to everything else in between. But there's a multiple different, what you would use for constipation, you would not, you know, like magnesium citrate, you know, that might not necessarily have the impact on the sleep side that the magnesium threonate would have.
And then L-theanine is a nice thing to take to kind of calm the brain. I like GABA, so taking PharmaGABA, which I think is a smaller molecule than GABA, so it's a lot easier to absorb. GABA is a great thing to take in the evening time to kind of help bring down cortisol, relax the brain, stay asleep. 5-HTP, you have to be careful with some of these things like 5-HTP. If you're on some kind of antidepressants or SSRIs, you got to be careful about that. But 5-hydroxytryptophan is great because it converts to serotonin, which converts to melatonin, which melatonin helps you fall asleep, but I don't find that it actually helps you stay asleep. And a lot of women tend to feel that kind of groggy, hungover feeling from taking melatonin. Men seem to do really well with melatonin, but some women can tolerate melatonin. It's great. And some women just can't take it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, melatonin seems like it works. It doesn't work about as often as it works, like 50-50. It's like a little bit of a roll of the dice if it's going to be effective for someone or not. We don't tend to push melatonin because usually by the time the patient has gotten to us, they've already probably tried melatonin. They've already had some experience with it. So melatonin can be, like you say, it's a sleep inducer. So it's good to help you fall asleep. It's not necessarily great at keeping you asleep. And you're right. Most people don't really like that melatonin hangover the following day. Although that usually in the beginning, if you haven't been sleeping well for a while, let's say months to even years, and now you actually start sleeping and you're groggy the following morning, that is usually your body's response to that sleep debt that you've accrued. And sometimes that grogginess starts to improve after about 5 to 7 days. So it can be beneficial just to be able to, you know, try to push through that for a little while just to see if it does resolve. Because, you know, a sleep debt, it doesn't really go away. Your body has to catch up at some point. You have to kind of go backwards a little bit of hypersomnia, kind of sleeping a little bit extra to kind of get those adrenals back in balance. And now you're You know, now you're sleeping consistently on a nightly basis, which, you know, that's a challenge in and of itself, right? That's really difficult for some women. I mean, some of the biggest challenges with some patients is actually just getting them to sleep. There's a few that I know that you have, that I have, that are, you know, it's really, really difficult in some situations. So there's also some herbs. Ashwagandha is really popular. Magnolia. There's some other things that can be done. Phosphatidylserine. You know,
Phosphatidylserine is really good. Valerian, of course, a lot of people know about that. Passion flower, lemon balm, Melissa officinalis. Glycine, I think, is also really good.
Yeah, we tend to use glycine when people have kind of that, your mom calls it motor mind, mm-hmm. You know, the racing thoughts at night. You know, you wake up and you're going through your laundry list of all the things you have to do. Men don't seem to have that problem as much, but women seem to have that one quite often. You know, they're just busy and have lots of things on their plate. You mentioned at night you're trying to, you know, kind of suppress or lower cortisol. Another way to approach that, because another pattern that we see a lot is people have this flipped curve, right? So they have low cortisol output in the morning, they have higher cortisol output in the evening into the night. So a way to kind of, you know, lower cortisol at night is to boost it up in the morning. And there can be some other herbs and different things that you can use in the morning. Because if you raise it in the morning consistently, then automatically you're going to get a suppressing effect to cortisol at night. You know, so you have this, what they call a diurnal curve, this rise and fall over a 24-hour period of cortisol. I mean, that has a huge impact on our sleep quality. Cortisol, the lack of cortisol is how we're able to fall asleep. You know, melatonin, as the sun sets, melatonin goes up, cortisol goes down. We're able to drift off to sleep. It's supposed to be a very kind of natural, inevitable process. But, you know, as we all know, in our busy kind of stress, sugar-filled world, you know, it can be really challenging to be able to shut the power off. We're go, go, go all day long, and now all of a sudden we just have to stop and rest. You know, that doesn't necessarily work for some people, and especially in the context of women that don't have any more female hormones. That's when it really seems to be exacerbated. You know, they're fine up until that point, and the minute those female hormones start to decline, you know, a woman entering her 40s, and now it's, you know, it's like a whole new ball game, and they don't really know what's going on. So any last final thoughts about Samantha and her issues?
No, I think we pretty much teased it apart pretty good.
Yeah.
Somebody else has some questions, feel free to write into us if you have any concerns.
Yeah. You can always send us an email at help@progressyourhealth.com. We haven't plugged your book in a little bit, but the book, Perimenopause Plans, available on Amazon. If you are in your 40s and you're looking for, you know, some answers, you know, just some simple things that we see on our consistent basis, hopefully will point you in the right direction. You can go to the website, perimenopauseplan.com, and that'll just redirect you to Amazon. So until next time, I guess we'll call it a wrap. So until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.